Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The summer music festival season is about to get bumping this week. This is Soundcheck. I'm Siddhartha Mitter, sitting in for John Schaefer. 25 years ago, hip-hop music and culture hit the silver screen with the film Wild Style. This month, the film's silver anniversary will be celebrated with the release of a behind-the-scenes book and a celebration at the third annual Brooklyn Hip-Hop Festival. But what makes this film a classic, and how relevant is it today? We are first joined by Charlie Ahern, who's the director of the cult film.
Hey.
Charlie, welcome. Wild Style was filmed in the late 1970s and the early 1980s in the South Bronx. What was important about that moment in New York arts and culture?
Well, there was a kind of gestation period with hip-hop where hip-hop was developing for a good 7 years before people began to really notice it. And one of the things that triggered that, of course, was the Sugar Hill Gang's Rapper's Delight sort of jump-started and shocked a lot of people. A lot of people in the Bronx were like, what? They turned around and they didn't know what hit them. They wanted to figure out how to get involved. And generally, hip-hop as a culture, though, was completely unknown outside of the neighborhoods of Brooklyn, Bronx, and some other spots.
So it wasn't just only a New York thing, which it was. It was very specific to certain particular neighborhoods.
Absolutely. And the idea that hip-hop was not only a form of music but a whole culture was something that people outside of that culture really weren't aware of particularly. So it was at that time that Fred Brathwaite was trying to get graffiti shown in galleries.
And that's the artist known also as Fab Five Freddy.
Fab Five Freddy, that's right. And so he and I hooked up in the summer of 1980 with the idea of creating a movie that would express the whole spectrum of hip-hop culture that involved graffiti on the subways, rap music, DJing, and b-boying.
As a filmmaker, what made you feel, what was your intuition that this was, in fact, movie material?
I used to hang out in 42nd Street and go look at kung fu movies. I was a big fan of Bruce Lee, and I always felt like those movies were kind of like, they were the visual culture that people had in the 70s, that they represented a kind of street pride that people had, and the fantasy that Fred and I always had was that our film would play on 42nd Street one day.
Well, let's listen to a clip from the movie. The key character in the movie is a graffiti artist called Zorro, and in this scene, he's talking to his friend about his art while they're watching graffiti go by on the elevated subways.
The lady said that some museum might be interested in their work.
What work?
They're doing graffiti on canvas.
So now they're making graffiti on canvas.
Graffiti ain't canvases. Graffiti's on the trains and on the walls, and they ain't got nothing to talk about.
Ah, I like that. Completely brand new. Being a graffiti writer is taking the chances and taking the risks, taking like all the arguments from the transit, from the police, from your own moms, you know, from your friends and you know, you got to take all that bullshit. Ah, you're vandalizing all those trains.
So a great deal of risk that was involved in the actual making of the graffiti by these artists at that time. How did you go about making the film? And you, how did you deal with the MTA, with the subways and so on to portray this as realistically as possible?
The MTA yards were really one of the most dramatic aspects in terms of the film production. We besieged them with letters and tried to make meetings with them. I was willing to put up about a third of the entire budget of the movie into some kind of bank account that the MTA had set aside to pay for 3 hours of time in an actual subway yard where we were going to shoot.
So the graffiti pieces that that we see being put on the subway cars during the film, were there pieces that were put up and that were scrubbed off? Or what's the balance between the documentary part here and the fictional part and how these pieces happened?
It's pretty complicated to talk about. The truth is that during the shooting of the film in the subway yard, it was pouring rain the whole time. So the paint did not actually stick to the trains. And I think as a film production, we went through, you know, the biblical disasters that are beyond imagine. We everything bad happened to us during the making of this movie. But that's part of this, you know, spiritual thing that you go through this hardship, and out on the other side, you have this kind of success.
We're talking to Charlie Ahern, who made the classic hip-hop movie, the first hip-hop movie, Wild Style, back in 1982. You're listening to Soundcheck on WNYC. I'm Siddhartha Mitter, filling in for John Schaefer. Charlie, this film is largely set in the South Bronx. There's a lot of Bronx pride here. The South Bronx was at the time something of a neglected disaster. We get a lot of neighborhood pride, race pride, empowerment. Is there an activist dimension, a neighborhood activist dimension to the movie?
I think there's an activist dimension in hip hop that is pretty much at the core of why the culture has succeeded so dramatically throughout the entire world. The idea of representing people that are normally shut aside or shut out from culture have found hip-hop to be an agreeable place where they can express themselves.
And the South Bronx, of course, was one of the seminal places where this was taking place. Let's listen to a clip. This is Grandmaster Caz, one of the great artists of the time, doing the South Bronx subway rap from the movie.
The garbage over the trains, under the ruins, through the remains, around the crime and pollution, and tell me where I fit in. South Bronx, New York, that's where I dwell. To a lot of people, it's a living hell, full of frustration and poverty. But wait, that's not how it looks to me. It's a challenge, an opportunity to rise above the stinking debris. You gotta start with nothing, and then you build, follow your dream until it's fulfilled. My art is my sword. A place in society is my reward. Because a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Success is something we all want to taste. Everyone has talent on this earth, and you can take it or leave it for what it's worth. No matter how hard things may seem, you've got the potential. Fulfill your dream, because we're the future, and it's up to us to make our home.
Grandmaster Caz, the South Bronx subway rap from Wild Style. Now, to talk about the importance of Wild Style and why it's a classic now, we have the privilege of being joined by another pioneer of hip-hop, Ralph McDaniels, who started the famous hip-hop video show Video Music Box back in 1984, and who is also the host of the Brooklyn Hip-Hop Festival, which is going on this month. Ralph, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Is Wild Style still relevant in the current hip-hop climate?
Absolutely. You know, it's a blueprint for, you know, what was going on at that time. And, you know, the original, it was never a formula because hip hop was always organic, but it was, you know, what was happening at that particular time. So any filmmaker that's out there needs to look at Wild Style and just know, you know, what this is all about.
Why did you guys decide to celebrate it at the festival this year?
I think that the Brooklyn Hip Hop Festival is kind of like, you know, a manifestation of exactly what Wild Style is all about, man. You know, it's like, you know, it comes exactly from that formula, you know, of just people going out in the park and having a good time. You know, it's not that fast food hip hop that we have today. It's the original formula of what we thought when we started going out in the parks and taking music out there and DJing and MCing and breaking. That's what the Brooklyn Hip Hop Festival is all about. So, you know, it's a cool thing. And Brooklyn Bodega has put together a very organic and nice, cool, calm event. You know, it's no hype. It's just real hip hop.
Now, we're talking about Brooklyn, and it's the Brooklyn Hip Hop Festival. And you yourself are from Brooklyn.
Absolutely.
If I have it right.
Yes.
And Wild Style is primarily set in the Bronx. There's some famous rivalries between boroughs and so on in the histories of the ancestry of hip hop. how does Wild Style speak to Brooklyn back in the day?
Well, it's funny because, you know, as a young guy coming up, you know, in fact, me and Charlie were just kind of talking about some ideas and, you know, I never used to go to the Bronx. Brooklyn never really went to the Bronx and Bronx never went to Brooklyn, you know. And if you know, Brooklyn people are very unique and Bronx people are very unique in their own ways, you know. So it was something that it was almost like going to Kansas to go to the Bronx. So, you know, to watch the movie Wild Style, you know, you learned a lot about Bronx people. And we just lived a couple of, you know, miles away. So it's pretty cool.
How much is that still the case, that kind of differentiation?
I think it's still the case for a lot. There's some people that, you know, that I grew up in my neighborhood of Bedford-Stuyvesant that probably have never really journeyed too far past, you know, downtown Brooklyn, you know, past Juniors. And that's just the way it is. And I'm sure it's like that in the Bronx.
Well, that gives some significance also to one of the great terms from that time, which was all city, right? Some of the graffiti artists mm-hmm. had to pride themselves in being all city. Can you explain sort of what that was and how that fits into the subway art?
Well, I mean, I'm not really a graffiti person, as probably Charlie would probably know a little bit more about the graffiti than I would. But, you know, all city means, you know, your work is kind of going around the whole, you know, on certain trains, if I'm not mistaken, right?
The thing about subway cars is that they travel throughout the whole city. And that the original source of graffiti was gang-related graffiti, mm-hmm. and that was to mark territory. So when you said you were going all city, that meant you were hitting the entire city.
Right.
That also meant that the trains traveled throughout the city. And it basically broke down that gang culture and really introduced a new sense of openness to everything.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the music and the performers that we have in Wild Style. You know, the film and the soundtrack, it includes performances by acts like Double Trouble, Busy Bee, the Cold Crush Brothers, the Fantastic Freaks, all these great names from back in the day. Ralph, how important were these artists to hip-hop?
They were very important. They were superstars, you know, in their own particular neighborhood. And we were in Brooklyn, you know, we were starting to get tapes or cassette tapes. Remember those? We were starting to get those leaked, you know, into our area of these particular performances, you know, especially with Cold Crush and Busy Bee. And Busy Bee is known for that infamous battle with Kool Moe Dee. Mm-hmm. And so those things were starting to leak into the neighborhood because this music wasn't getting played on the radio at all at that particular time. Maybe late night, you know, late night radio, you know, or some type of college radio, and you had opportunities to hear it. So the music was emerging. The visuals were emerging, of course, with Charlie, what Charlie was doing and what I was doing on television as well. And, you know, it was just the beginning of a whole movement. I mean, it was, you know, it was hip hop. It was punk. There was a lot of things happening at that particular time that were very cool.
It was a very fertile time, wasn't
it?
Yeah. Well, let's get an idea of what the sound, what the performance sound in the film sounds like. This is a clip of Ruby Dee of the Fantastic Freaks. I don't think I'm fly, you can't deny. Better be down the rock as I am. A nice guy, a Ruby D, my brother, my man. But just get on the mic and take the man.
Well, Ruby D is my name, and I'm a Puerto Rican. You might think I'm black by the way I'm speaking. I'm sick, I'm hustling with a lot of guns. That's the reason I attract all the sweet fly girl. The other reason is I am profile. The mates or the lady know I'm worth the five. But I'm too hot to burn, too cold to hold. Ruby D's in the place, and you must say, no, that I'm bad.
Charlie, Ruby Dee is Puerto Rican. He says so very explicitly.
Right. Well, I want to clarify, first of all, that this is the Fantastic Freaks at the Dixie. And what you're focusing on is Ruby Dee is one of five MCs. And he's the first MC that happens to come up in this particular selection.
That's right. And they're
so
performing.
It's really the Fantastic that we're hearing.
Right. And they're performing back and forth in this form of the battle, which is also, we could say, maybe one of the slightly lost arts in hip-hop. But let me ask you this. Ruby Dee, in this particular clip, he does announce himself as being Puerto Rican, this particular
absolutely.
Rapper.
And he says, you might think I'm black by the way that I'm speaking.
Right.
And that's a great rhyme with Puerto Rican.
Exactly.
And that gets to something about the character of the time, because, Lee Quiñones, who is the actual graffiti artist who plays Zorro in the film, is also Latino. Tell us a little bit about the Latino presence at these early days of hip-hop.
Well, primarily, the music of hip-hop was primarily a black thing. It was an African-American thing. And there were significant DJs like Charlie Chase. There were significant MCs like Prince Whip-a-Whip or Ruby Dee that did enter this, and they were accepted. And, you know, Latinos were accepted into the Zulu Nation that Bambaataa was doing. And it was part of hip-hop, this idea of embracing people from beyond the block.
In fact, there were a lot of white kids who were also involved in the graffiti movement as well, weren't there?
The graffiti movement was always a mixed thing. From the very day one, that was one of the things that made graffiti so radical, is that up to that point, the gangs were very much segregated into the Guineas, the different groups that right. were, and graffiti broke that down and created new lines of membership.
And in fact, graffiti is, Ralph, one of the big presences at the Brooklyn Hip Hop Festival, right? You're representing the famous five elements of hip hop, one of which is graffiti. Mm-hmm. You know, why do you think that graffiti doesn't have that much of a presence? Why is this a nostalgic thing that we have to go back to graffiti? It doesn't have the same presence that it used to have in hip hop.
I think that, you know, well, a lot of the artwork and a lot of the design is gone now. It's not, everything is about an MP3 and a download, so we don't have album covers and all kinds of cool stuff like that. I think that if more of that existed, like when we were growing up, Charlie, we'd see more. I loved the artwork, you know, on album covers. And now, then it went to CD covers. Now we don't even have CD covers anymore. So that kind of stuff is kind of like fading away, at least from the music side. And but worldwide, I think that graffiti still has a major importance, you know, around the world. You know, we're talking about New York City. You know, we kind of digest stuff and just throw it away. But, you know, you go to, you know, Japan and you go to Germany and, you know, and the graffiti and the graph is still major. And, you know, and these guys go over, these artists go over there and they're looked at as major artists.
And even at the time of the making of Wild Style in these early late 70s, early 80s, graffiti was already getting caught up in certain dynamics. And I think we can get an idea of that from another clip from the movie. This is Zorro, who's in an art collector's apartment, and he's explaining to a TV producer, I believe, how he makes his art.
Can I call you Zorro?
No. I'd be better off if you just call me Raymond.
Raymond, you can't paint them in the subway stations.
Well, graffiti has its own spots.
In special places, like at night, you have to sneak in.
You can say that.
Well, if you work in the dark, how can you see what you're painting?
Well, I can't see what I'm painting, but I do know what I'm drawing, and I know my colors by heart already.
Do you ever get chased, caught?
Yeah, I've gotten chased so many times, but the knuckleheads never got to catch me, you know.
That's a great clip. Charlie, tell us a little bit about where this is taking place.
Okay, first I want to say that I could feel Lee's, like, this is Lee speaking from the heart. Mm. I could tell that this doesn't sound to me like something I wrote for him to memorize. He's responding to this individual in a real way, which is really what happens throughout the film.
And we should say that Lee Quiñones was one of the...
Lee was probably the most respected subway graffiti writer at that time. And he was still out there in the yards as well as in these kinds of situations. And we brought this scene to Neva Kislek, who was a very strong collector of modern art. She had Frank Stella's Roy Lichtenstein's in her apartment. She also was very interested in graffiti art. So when you watch that scene, you're actually seeing something that's been reoccurring and that reflects very deeply something that's true.
You've gone to you've got a book about the film coming out now, Wild Style, The Sampler. It's a behind-the-scenes look at the movie and the graffiti. Why release a book about this now?
Well, I like the idea of the sampler because, to me, the concept of the sampler is that hip-hop is a hall of mirrors. It's kind of like the end of Enter the Dragon with Bruce Lee, where he enters that hall of mirrors.
Kung Fu again.
I mean, hip-hop is a hall of mirrors, and the more you know about the culture of hip-hop, you realize that you're seeing infinitesimal refractions of past cultures. You know, you could go back, you know, if you want to get deep into it, centuries, but we'll go back into it only a few years, so that when you have, let's say, Nas sampling a piece from Wild Style and talking about it on his classic Illmatic album, that's a sample that we hold very dearly.
That's right, and the movie has obtained kind of this cult following amongst hip-hop producers. Tell us a little bit, this is a question for both of you, really, Ralph. How has the movie and the elements of this movie survived and infiltrated the rest of hip-hop in the past 25 years?
Well, I think that, you know, I mean, I'm sure, you know, Charlie's made, you know, a couple of dollars off of Wild Style, but I think that it's had a slow, gradual, you know, like, you know, burn, and which is great. You know, like, you know, things come out so fast nowadays that they just burn out and you're so tired of them, but you never get tired of Wild Style. And it's a classic, and some people are just now today, you know, getting, you know, their first touch of what Wild Style is all about. So I think that's great, you know, and I'm always, you know, amazed that, you know, I just saw Wild Style, and I'm like, really? It's been out for 25 years, but that's incredible, and I think that's a good thing. So it stood the test of time, you know. It's one of those films that people are still trying to dissect. It means that you created, like your Chinese movies that you enjoyed growing up, you right. created many chambers, Charlie,
yes.
and that's what's what makes it interesting.
Chamber.
Exactly.
Well, I have to say that having had the pleasure of re-seeing the movie, you know, yesterday, and if you're sort of a connoisseur of hip hop, you recognize so many things from this, and one of them you mentioned, Charlie, just now, is the great sample that Nas, the great hip hop artist Nas, did at the beginning of his first album, Illmatic. The Genesis, and this comes straight out of Wild Style. I want to thank you both for coming in, Charlie Ahern, who made the movie Wild Style in 1982, and Ralph McDaniels.
Brooklyn Hip Hop Festival
going on this month.
Yes, go to brooklynbodega.com.
Thank you so much, both of you, for coming into Soundcheck. And coming up next, Audra McDonald. She's no mere Broadway diva. The star of the musical 110 in the Shade is also a successful TV actress. She's also a recording artist and an opera singer. And yes, she is up for another Tony. We'll talk with Audra McDonald next. Everything beautiful happens at night. Everything beautiful happens after the day. This is Soundcheck on WNYC. I'm Siddhartha Mitter, filling in for John Schaefer. There's a big reason why theatergoers are pouring in to see 110 in the Shade, the 1963 musical that's playing in revival at the Roundabout Theater. That reason is Audra McDonald. She's the lead actress who's a four-time Tony Award winner and has been nominated for a fifth Tony for this role. Audra is not only a familiar face on Broadway, her extremely diverse career has taken her from concert halls to television, and even to the opera stage. And I'm pleased to welcome Audra to Soundcheck. Audra McDonald, welcome.
Thank you, Siddhartha.
So 110 in the Shade, it had a nice run, I guess, on Broadway in 1963, but it wasn't really a big hit. And on the surface, it can seem a little bit dated now.
Yeah.
It's the story of a father and two brothers who are trying to get their sister, who's sort of a plain Jane homemaker called Lizzie Curry, they're trying to get her a husband. Why would you take this role on?
Well, I think in describing it that way, that's actually somewhat of an incorrect way of actually sort of describing the piece. The piece is actually, I think, about a woman named Lizzie Curry who is a homemaker, who is sort of mother, sister, and wife all rolled up into one for her father and two brothers, because there is no mom in the household. And she is not the most attractive woman in the world, and is someone who very much speaks her mind and has grown up very much in a male world, and is someone who is desperately lonely and wants more than anything to find love. It's not so much that her family's trying to marry her off, it's that she's desperate to find love. If Lizzie's too strong of a person, if she didn't want to be married, she wouldn't be. She wants to.
And it's set in this piece of really sort of romanticized Americana, isn't it?
Yes, it takes place during the Dust Bowl era in the 30s, and I think, which is very interesting, because, you know, you can see sort of the battles, you know, the battle with the elements, you know, and everybody just wants it to rain. They're so desperate for, you know, relief from the heat, and, you know, and so the metaphor between the relief from the heat and you know, for Lizzie's, you know, feeling like she's drying up and she will never ever experience love, and for this con man to come in and bring love into her heart, ends up bringing rain to the land.
That's right. So the chief theater critic of the New York Times, Ben Brantley, wrote this very, very glowing review in which he did say 110 Degrees in the Shade remains family entertainment only for families without feminists. Do you see this as in any way an anti-feminist role or play?
No, I don't at all, because it's sometimes people make the mistake, you know, when Showboat is revived, no one says, well, my goodness, they've got slaves in there. What's wrong with these people? It was of the time. And this is a revival of a show that was written in 1963 about people in the 1930s. And in the 1930s, getting married was very much something that women did in that time. And more so than that, I think it's this one woman's particular journey that, you know, so for me, I don't see it as you know, I consider myself to be a feminist, and I'm very much, I live in the left, and I, you know, I, you know, in terms of all that. So I am not offended by anything that happens in this world, but maybe it's because I also love the character so much and I understand her journey.
So poor Lizzie, she's presented as plain and mm-hmm. she wrestles with herself. She thinks of herself as plain and it's being reinforced by various people around her. I have to ask you, was it hard to de-glamorize yourself and to tap into this this naivete, shall we say?
Not at all. It's so funny when people say, oh, well, they make her up to look plain. And in the actual truth, I don't wear makeup. And that in and of itself makes me look plenty plain. But the thing is, it's not just that she's not the prettiest girl in the world. It's that she's someone who does not have a filter. She says what she's thinking. And she always speaks the truth. And she says it no matter whether the time is right or not. And so she ends up offending a lot of people. She's not the most likable person in the beginning. And so there, it has to do with the struggle, you know, on the inside of her not feeling beautiful and her not feeling like what she has to offer is good enough. I think that is what it is, more so than she just doesn't have the looks.
Well, let's hear a little bit of her expressing herself in the play. This is from Act 1 of 110 in the Shade. The song is Love, Don't Turn Away.
I have so many things I want to do for you. I have so many things saved up to say. I have so many longings that belong to you. So love, don't turn away. I have so many songs I want to sing to you. I have so many smiles that I could cry. I have so many kisses I could bring to you. So long, don't pass me by. I can't offer you lots.
That's Audra McDonald singing Love, Don't Turn Away from the play 110 in the Shade. Audra is with us on Soundcheck on WNYC, and I'm Siddhartha Mitter filling in for John Schaefer. Audra, the cast recording of 110 in the Shade is out today, as it happens, and I know that it's dedicated to your father, who passed away unexpectedly last month, and we're all very sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Did having the show help you get through it?
Yeah, you know, it was 5 weeks ago last Sunday. And the show really helps in that it gives me something to focus on. And also working through a lot of the father-daughter relationships within the show, it's actually a way for me to really honor him. So I'm thankful that I have it. You know, when you're dealing with a shocking tragedy like that and such a sudden and unexpected death, it's always good to have something to sort of wrap your mind around. Otherwise, you think you go a little cuckoo.
Well, the father-daughter relationship in the show that you just mentioned is really, really fundamental, and the two of you play it incredibly well. Can you tell us a little bit about it, and how did you draw on your own personal experience in inhabiting the part?
Well, I tell you, working with John Cullum, who is, you know, just a legend of the stage and screen, he's done everything, and he's seen everything, and so there's just an immediate comfort level with him, and he's also someone who is just willing to go wherever you want to go in terms of a scene. If you want to play it one way one night, he's there to hit the ball back. If you want to play it another way, he's right there. Sometimes he'll throw a curveball, which is fantastic, and that keeps it alive. But Lizzie only has her father. That's her confidant. That's everything. That's her mom. That's her dad. That's her confidant. That's her best friend. It's the only person who she feels truly understands her and loves her and thinks she's beautiful is her dad. So he bears a lot of responsibility for everything that he must be to her, and all he wants is for her to be happy, you know, and he knows that for her to be happy, that is to find a mate. And so they take care of each other, I think, in a very sweet way. You know, actually at a point in the show when she's really about ready to just sort of fall apart, instead of saying, oh, honey, life is going to get better, he says, oh, you want to be like all those other girls? And then he sort of makes her sort of steel herself. And out of it comes this great number of raunchy where she starts making fun of all these sort of like silly little girls that she doesn't want to be like, which I think is a wonderful thing. And, you know, it just speaks to their strength.
I think you mentioned raunchy. It's a faux burlesque number.
Yeah.
And why don't you set it up a little bit? Can we get a sense of the staging?
Sure. What's happening is, you know, as I've just said, she's really feeling down about herself and feeling like she asks, do I have to be a woman? Do I need to get lessons in order to be a woman? Am I a woman? And you know, he says, you want to go down and be Lillian Beasley? And she says, well, you know, those little girls at the social club, they know how to get along. And then she says, he says, fine, go be one of them. And she says, fine. Mm-hmm. And so she starts to make up how she would be one of those little silly girls down at the social club.
Let's hear a little bit of what she does. This is Raunchy from 110 in the Shade.
Well, you just watch. Dancing in my pink and green satin, feeling like a queen, wearing Maybelline, I'll be so raunchy, gonna make them other gals turn green, honky tonkin' every night, I'm a raunchy kind of gal. I'll be so raunchy, sipping Dr. Pepper mixed with booze, burning like a fuse, shaking like a boots. I'll be so raunchy, stepping in my patent leather shoes. When the cowboys see me strut my stuff, gonna crawl.
And that's raunchy Audra McDonald singing from 110 in
that's
the Shade.
That's a raunchy Audra McDonald.
And it's a great number, and I can only encourage people to go and see the play to get it in its full.
Yeah, we're actually going to perform that number on the Tonys, so people can tune in on Sunday night and watch.
In its full force, that's great. Now, one of the really refreshing things about the performance is the interracial or race-blind character of it. So sort of at the risk of taking away that refreshingness to it, let's talk about that for a second. Does it in fact make a difference what the race of any of these characters is?
I think not necessarily. If you're willing to, you know, suspend disbelief when you walk into the theater, anyway, not necessarily, because this isn't a show about one particular historical event. This is, you know, this is about, you know, sort of familial issues, universal issues, issues with being a woman, feeling like a woman, being alone. These are all universal issues that human beings deal with, you know. So I think what we've been able to do is just sort of create the family, we have John Cullum, who is of course Caucasian. I'm African American. One of my brothers is African American. He's actually biracial, and another one is Caucasian. But it doesn't matter. I mean, we have really developed a family unit, and I think that's what's most important, you know. And when you just sort of throw that out the door the minute you walk in, I think it allows the audience just to come in. And I tell you, people have come up to me and said they've had more problems with thinking I'm not quote-unquote pretty enough, which, you know, whatever. But that's more supposedly their problem than the African-American issue. So,
well, and I have to say, I forget, in one of the pieces of coverage of the show, there was a discussion of, well, technically, you could say maybe their mother, who's not present, was African-American, and that would explain why the family looks like it is. But in fact, if you see the show, it really doesn't matter.
I think it goes away. I think you're not thinking about that, you know.
And the New Yorker, a review in the New Yorker, kind of drew an interesting contrast between this and the atmosphere that prevails, say, in Hollywood. It says, if movies were as colorblind as they should be, McDonald could be her generation's Meryl Streep. How different does that color issue play in Hollywood versus Broadway versus opera, all these different pieces of performance that you're involved in?
Well, I think, you know, Hollywood is a different beast, and I think, you know, they're dealing with so much more money and so many more sort of cooks in the kitchen. You know, a lot of their money comes from advertisers and whatnot. I think it's just not nearly as open-minded, you know, when you're trying to play to a broader base, whereas opera is so far ahead of everything, where it's always been about, you know, look, if you can sing it, if you've got that high C, fine, you can play this role. We don't care that you're, you know, Caucasian playing, you know, an Ethiopian princess. That's fine, because you've got the high C, so whatever, you know. I think Broadway is somewhere in the middle. I think certainly we've seen a lot of changes in the past 15 to 20 years, and I think people's eyes are opening even more and more in that respect to just, you know, if it is not necessarily a historical thing that you're dealing with, then yes, let's just cast whoever's right for the role. I mean, if you're doing Porgy and Bess, if you're doing Showboat, things like that, of course, Raisin in the Sun. Okay, that's about an African-American experience.
You can't get away from it.
No, no. But I think there are cases when you can.
Well, you were mentioning opera and technique. The high C's are important in opera, and it's fairly unusual, the extreme range of different performance stages that you've put yourself on. Last year, you made your debut at the Houston Grand Opera,
yeah.
And in February, you made your debut at the Los Angeles Opera.
Yeah, playing a big old whore in Mahagoni.
In Kurt Weill's The
yes.
Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni.
Yes.
Tell me about the difference. Is it shorter runs? Is it different vocal emphasis?
Yes, yes, and yes. You know, when we finished I did Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni in Los Angeles with Patti LuPone. She and I both, you know, obviously come from the Broadway world, and we realized that by the time we got to our final performance, which was we did 7 performances over a course of a month, that would have equaled not even 1 week of previews on Broadway, which was amazing to us. And it is definitely, you know, it's first and foremost about the voice. And you know, sacrificing any sort of vocal technique or purity of tone for dramatic influence, let's say, is not always, you know, thought to be the best thing, whereas in Broadway, that's not so important. You know, there's the issue of amplification. We had a little bit of amplification with, you know, we use some microphones, although you're not really supposed to. That's, you know, the ivory tower sort of thought that mm-hmm. you're not really supposed to use amplification with opera. And I think it may attract slightly a different audience. You know, the one thing that was interesting, I think, is because Patti LuPone and I were involved with it, I think people who would not normally have come to the opera did come because they were curious as to what these what we called it Broadway trash doing in the opera world.
Is there a way that sort of every performance counts? The stakes are higher in each
it
performance.
It felt that way, and it felt like we never got a chance to sort of settle in and get comfortable with it because the performances were so spaced out. But I understand why they're so spaced out, because vocally the demands tend to be a little more strenuous, you know, because the emphasis is so much on the purity of the tone and of the voice.
So you have a different kind of fatigue when you come out of the performance?
In a way, yes. I would say so.
Well, another form that you're involved in, you've worked frequently with a whole new generation of musical theater and art song mm-hmm. composers.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to hear a clip. This is a song by one of them, Adam Gettel. And this is the title track from your last album, Build a Bridge.
Yes, I need you. And I love you. Waters wide. Oh yes, I am trying to get there. To battle the tide, build a bridge, come to shore. This I've heard before. Ah, ah, I'll be coming. I am trying.
That's Audrey McDonald singing Build a Bridge, the title track from her album Build a Bridge. The song is by Adam Gettel. You do Broadway, you do concerts, you do television. Your husband is also a performing artist. I believe he's a bassist, right?
He's a bassist, yes. We met at school at Juilliard, yeah.
And he's currently in the pit for Mary Poppins.
He's in the pit, Mary Poppins, and he's on the road with Barbara Cook.
So there's this question about how do you balance, you know, motherhood with your daughter. But
yes.
It's the same question for him, really, isn't it? How does he balance fatherhood?
Yeah,
it's
very difficult. It's a give and take. And because we're in a business that's not consistent, you know, I mean, we just take it one day at a time is really the way you have to do it, you know. But we do like the fact that she's growing up so, you know, influenced by music and also so a part of the theater. She knows her way around a theater. She knows her way around a tech. And I love that. I have always wanted that. I mean, I still want her to grow up and be a doctor or something else, but
oh, really?
I want her to have a real healthy appreciation for the performing arts, and I know she'll at least have that.
So the two of you together are finding ways does she become a factor in your career choices, in your performance and acting choices?
Oh, sure. I mean, especially the older she gets. And, you know, the one thing I've always loved about being a performer is we don't keep the same hours as other people do, you know, in the sense that when everybody's leaving the city at night, we're just going into the city, or, you know, we have Mondays off, you mm-hmm. know, and I've always enjoyed that. But now that we have a kid who's, you know, in kindergarten, now going to first grade, we don't have that freedom anymore. We're sort of being relegated to being a part of, you know, most of the working world where, you know, you get your summers off and you have to get up at the crack of dawn to get the kid to school and all that stuff. And so that's a big adjustment for us.
Well, you've been an original cast now of 7 Broadway productions. You've been nominated for Tonys for 6 of these productions. Do you feel the pressure to keep the track record going?
No, I don't. You know, motherhood changed everything. You know, for me now, it's really just about trying to grow as an artist and do good work. That's most important to me. You know, if the accolades come, I'm going to be thankful and grateful and honored, but you really have no control over that, I feel.
Well, I guess we'll see what happens on Sunday night. The Tony Awards are Sunday night. You can watch and root for Audrey McDonald. The play, 110 in the Shade, is running through July 15th at the Roundabout.
The 29th, actually, now. We're through July 29th.
We've extended again to July 29th at the Roundabout Theater. We'll wrap up. This is another track from Build a Bridge. This is a song, Wonderful You. And Audrey McDonald, thank you so much for coming out to Soundcheck.
Thank you. Good time.
You're under public investigation, and you're everybody's private fascination. You are wonderful, you. Nobody else is gonna do. I am sad, oh, wonderful, you. Nobody else is gonna do. I am sad, oh, wonderful, you. You always say that life is good. Keep the lid.